From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the Local Edition. And I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Coming up, as students return to classrooms, parents, teachers, and health advocates are trying to stem the rising tide of nicotine use among the young people. Patricio Rubio talks to the American Lung Association coming up in the second half of the program. And I will get the latest news from the Times Union Hudson Valley, including a big update on a musical institution of the Catskills, Levon Helm Studios. But first, we're going to start with an update on ICE. Federal immigration agents are going to get another weapon to use as they make record numbers of arrests and deportations of immigrants. Next year, they will receive gloves that are like a handheld taser. They deliver an electric shock when an officer puts their hand on a person's skin. New York State Attorney General Letitia James said Wednesday the technology appears to violate the law and the Constitution.
Of course we are outraged, and in the event that a New Yorker is injured as a result of these gloves, obviously there will be a private right of action as well as action from the state of New York. You can best be assured of that.
Governor Kathy Hochul said the state is studying the issue and could sue.
That appears to me on its face to be a violation of civil rights, to cause that kind of physical harm to an individual, regardless of what the offense may be.
A manual for the device says it's not to be used on children, seniors, pregnant women, and people with severe disabilities. The manual says the device is safe if used properly, but it can also increase blood pressure, heart rates, or rhythms, breathing, or other factors that can cause sudden death. In other news, a state lawmaker from New York City will be traveling upstate to organize opposition to data centers. WNYC's Jimmy Vielkind reports.
State Senator Kristen Gonzalez sponsors a broad moratorium on developing data centers. The chair of the Senate's Technology Committee says she wants her trip to raise awareness of communities where new server farms are proposed.
I really believe that we can set a standard for responsible data center development, but not only that, a standard for fighting AI data centers and big tech corporate greed here in New York for the rest of the country.
Gonzalez plans to visit Buffalo, the Finger Lakes, and the Stamp Industrial Park in Genesee County. She's hoping Governor Hochul will sign her moratorium bill. The Democratic governor already issued an executive order pausing construction on large data centers for a year. Tech companies say the moratoriums cost jobs. In Albany, I'm Jimmy Vielkind for the New York Public News Network.
Thank you to the New York Public News Network for those reports. Now for the latest news from the Hudson Valley and Catskills, I spoke with Lana Bellamy, Times Union, earlier this afternoon. Lana Bellamy, welcome to the Local Edition.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start off, you've got an update on the dispute over Levon Helm Studios, a story we've been following here on Radio Catskill, but I want to let people know Levon Helm, drummer and singer with the band, built the studio in the 70s. It's like a Catskills barn up near Woodstock, and he used it, especially in his later years, to host recording sessions and performances, in part as a way to generate revenue for himself and his family. But there has been a lot of internal dispute up at Levon Helm Studios, especially this past year. Can you give folks some background on that before we dive into the latest?
Sure, yes, and I'll try to keep it as succinct as possible because it gets rather complicated, as many people following this know. But basically, this feud has been divided between Amy Helm, who is the daughter of Levon Helm, and Brian Perillo, the new CEO of Levon Helm Studios. And on Brian's side is also Sandra Helm, who is Levon's widow and Amy's stepmother. So Amy Helm on one side, Brian Perillo, and Sandra Helm on the other. And both sides have been accusing each other of financial misconduct. So before this all really erupted into the public sphere, there had already been some more private battles going on. All the way back a year ago in May, Amy had asked Ulster County's surrogate court to remove Sandra as administrator of Levon's estate, accusing her of mismanaging estate funds. But in the court filings, she also said that she believed that Perillo had been financially exploiting and manipulating Sandra, who was in her middle 70s. And of course, you know, Perillo has called those accusations categorically false. So that's sort of the short, I guess, version of all of this and in the dust up. many artists have been canceling their Midnight Ramble performances and really kind of like circling around Amy in support of her in this feud. But now we have what is, you know, pretty much representing the latest twist in this, or latest update, I guess, in this dispute, where Levon Helm Studios has filed a federal lawsuit in district court against Amy Helm and six others.
Okay, so, and I'll just point out for people there that that's Brian Perillo is the current CEO of Levon Helm Studios, and he became CEO when Sandra Helm, you know, put her shares of the company, you know, in support of him. And, you know, when Amy Helm filed those complaints last year, it was shortly after he became CEO. So Levon Helm Studios is filing this lawsuit under Mr. Perillo. What are they alleging in this suit?
Sure. Yes. A lot of the lawsuit, if you were to sort of sum it up into two kind of umbrella major things, a lot of it focuses on the use of the Midnight Ramble trademark. And the Midnight Ramble sessions are these, you know, pretty famous jam sessions that they hold at the barn and have been doing for 20 or so years. And then the other part of the lawsuit is accusing Amy of self-dealing using company money, basically. So it accuses her and six others of a years-long scheme to use company money for personal and professional gain, and undermining the institution after she was removed as its president.
Yeah, and here's where I should just point out for people that I realize that Amy Helm is a musician. You know, she used to perform with her father, sang with her father at Bethel Woods for the Woodstock anniversary. And one of the accusations of self-dealing is that she used some of Levon Helm Studios money towards, you know, her touring expenses and things like that.
Yes. So that is an important note, especially as other artists and musicians have come you know, rushing to support her in this feud. So the lawsuit and the other people who are named in it, so it's accusing Amy Helm, her former attorney, the company's former accountant, her booking agent, and three former employees of helping her with, you know, what they're accusing her as far as financial misconduct. The complaint is seeking at least $2 million in damages. They want a jury trial on this matter, and they also want the judge to issue a permanent injunction that would bar Helm from using the Helm Family Midnight Ramble name or any similar sort of iteration of the Midnight Ramble trademark.
Right, right. You know, this suit was just filed on Monday. So this is a new development in this story. Any response from Amy Helm yet?
I'm glad you asked, because we didn't receive a response, but I did see earlier today that our friends at the Daily Freeman in Kingston received a statement from her. And she is probably responding in a way that you would assume, which is, you know, saying that she has not, you know, been acting in any sort of, you know, like illegal or nefarious way. So her statement to them was, once again, hustlers are attempting to scare and intimidate me. And once again, it is all a spin. The same garbage over and over again, spoon fed to the media is an attempt to smear my name and make a cash grab. In other words, extortion is what she said.
Right. And I guess next steps will be to see if Amy Helm responds any further, or we'll just see how the suit proceeds in court. I'm Jason Dole. This is the Local Edition. I'm talking to Lana Bellamy from Times Union. Lana, your next story is about the IBM campus near Warwick. IBM, a major business in the Hudson Valley, held a lot of property in the region, but a lot of it isn't really being used right now. What's the latest on this property in Warwick?
Oh, yes. This is something, as a former Orange County reporter, I have been interested in for a while when I learned that the Jehovah's Witnesses organization had their world headquarters in Warwick, of all places.
It's their world headquarters in Warwick, New York?
It is. And, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses is quite a global, you know, organization. So, and it's very close to the town of Tuxedo. It's in the Sterling Forest, so it's in a pretty rural area, and very close to where their headquarters is. I think it's less than a mile or about a mile from that site, is a 68-acre campus that used to belong to IBM, and it had a data center on it. And Jehovah's Witnesses just recently purchased that campus. Okay. And it's unclear exactly what they're going to do with it, but just the fact that they purchased it and they're expanding their footprint down there and that it has a data center on it is interesting enough.
Yeah, what if anything, does this mean for the surrounding communities? Because, again, since IBM was such a big business, it made such an impact in the region and had so much property, I mean, that's the sort of thing that local communities have been keeping an eye on. So is there any indication as to what this might mean, or is there any even response from the local communities to this news?
You know, it's funny because I haven't heard much response from it, just a lot of people, I think, who are curious about it. It's not very densely populated in that particular area. It's pretty rural, if you ask me. And, you know, IBM, since it has shrunk all around the region, local economic development agencies have been trying to figure out, you know, what to do with these sites. And we weren't able to get anything too specific out of Orange County itself, but I'm sure they have been thinking, you know, should we try to help market this? You know, who can move in here to keep this place running and use it and contributing, you know, to the community?
Yeah, and with it being a religious organization, does that mean that they have or will file for a tax-exempt status as they seek to use these properties?
I was just thinking about that, too. And I'm not sure. We haven't really gotten that far yet. I would assume that since they're a religious organization that they would seek tax-exempt status.
Yeah, and the article mentions that, you know, an unnamed spokesperson with Jehovah's Witness organization, didn't provide any more details about the intended use, and that includes whether or not the group will continue operating the existing data center or pursue tax exemptions or permits. So I think this is another one where, like, you've identified the big news, and now we kind of have to wait and see what happens.
Yeah, it's definitely more of a starting, like, jumping off point for future reporting. And I think really an interesting aspect of what this story kind of lays out is how it's contributing really to the group's growing footprint in the Hudson Valley. So part of the history is that it used to have its world headquarters in Brooklyn, and then it relocated to the Hudson Valley in 2016. So it started up in Ulster County in the hamlet of Walk Hill, and then later moved to the site that they're at now in Warwick. But there are also these other pretty large campuses all around. There's this visitor center at the Watchtower Educational Center in Putnam County in Walk Hill, where they used to be headquartered. They have Watchtower Farms, and they pretty recently opened the Fishkill Support Center in Dutchess County. But I think the biggest development is the one that's in progress right now, which is a new media center. And it's on a 249-acre property in Ramapo in Rockland County.
Wow. Well, it sounds like their organization must be doing well then.
It sounds like it, yes.
If they're doing a lot of building and expanding. So, all right. Well, thank you for that update. And now one more story here is we had a lot of rain in the region last couple of weeks. And there's been some storm impact over in Catskill, New York, correct?
Oh, yes. So this is coming off of the pretty historic rainfall that the Capital Region in particular, I'm sure listeners will remember when Albany, it was like the rainstorm system just set on Albany and kept spinning and hitting it over and over again with rain. And, You would see flooded streets. It was on the world news. This is the same storm that brought about 10 inches to the village of Catskill as well. And that was back on July 29th. And ever since then, the village of Catskill has been under a boil water advisory.
Wow. Still? Are they still now?
Yes, they are still now.
Oh, my goodness.
So our reporter, Roger Hannigan-Gilson, he kind of did a short dive into what's going on there because, you know, the hook was that we learned that they had to bring in this huge water tanker. It was a 6,700-gallon water tanker into the village so that, you know, businesses and residents and other water customers could get potable water. And what happened was that deluge of rainwater that entered the system at the village's filtration plant, it kicked up a lot of sediment, which is, and that cloudiness that it causes when it does that is referred to as turbidity. And the village treats its water with chlorine, and the turbidity interferes with the chlorine treatment. So it makes it very difficult or impossible to treat their water while they're dealing with this cloudiness until it settles back down. And apparently that is taking quite a while. And then after it does start to settle down, they have to go through at the plant, you know, like a series of tests, and then they have to send those tests off and then wait for results to come back. So even once it starts to get to a more normal threshold, like what was the case when Roger wrote about this at the beginning of the week, you still have to account for maybe like a week or several days before you're going to be able to get those tests back, and you can finally they can finally apply to the state to have the boil water advisory lifted.
My goodness. I'm wondering if they're working on any long-term solutions to this, but in the meantime, what are people doing for water?
Well, Roger did talk to a couple people who were coming. He went to the water tanker to check it out and then saw some people who were filling up there. A lot of people said that they were buying bottled water. And they didn't. This is on Monday, so this was the 14th day on Monday. And he said the impression he got from most people is that they weren't quite too upset yet. They were just kind of accepting that this was, like, you know, just a temporary inconvenience that they were going to be okay with. But he did talk to one business owner who said that if, you know, he's having to use like bottled water and other means to wash his dishes and cook. And he could put up with it for so long, but if it was still going on by Friday, which is tomorrow, then he would probably have to temporarily close. So people are dealing with it now, but I think that if it goes on a lot longer, then people will start to get a little bit more distressed about it.
Right. And that that restaurant owner you were talking about, I see here, is John Jimenez. His restaurant is The Salad Bar. And, man, if you name your restaurant Salad Bar, you're going to be using a lot of water just for cleaning the lettuce and everything. But, I mean, obviously restaurants need water. But I love the quote here. It says, it's annoying and, quote, adds a lot to your day. So you definitely get the sense of people that are, like, you know, dealing with it, trying to get by. But, like, as you said, he's like, boy, if this isn't fixed by Friday, you know, then they're going to be in trouble.
Yeah, well, that does actually really resonate with me, too, because I know just it's a completely different business. But even in our business, it's like every little additional process you have to insert into your day, it just you feel how yeah. much it adds to it. And I'm sure that this is adding a lot to his, too.
Absolutely. For now, I'll just say thank you so much, Lana, for going over all these stories, which are all up now at timesunion.com. That's timesunion.com. We're talking to Lana Bellamy, editor with Times Union Hudson Valley. Lana, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Talk to you later.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It is The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole, and we have an update on underage nicotine vaping here in back-to-school season. As students return to classrooms, parents, teachers, and health advocates are trying to stem the use of youth nicotine use. E-cigarette use among young people has declined from an earlier peak, but vapes remain the most commonly used tobacco product among middle and high school students, and use of nicotine pouches is also on the rise. Radio Catskills' Patricia Rubio spoke to Brian King, Executive Vice President for U.S. Programs at the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, to discuss what families and schools should know this year.
Brian, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So, Brian, as students return to school, how serious is youth vaping and nicotine use right now?
Well, we've made commendable progress reducing tobacco product use among U.S. youth, including in the state of New York and in New York City. Tobacco product use is at the lowest level in 25 years, and we've seen a marked decline in e-cigarette use over the past half decade. That said, we still have 1 in 10 U.S. youth who are using these products, and we know that among the youth who are using them, about a third of them are using these products daily. And so it still continues to be a public health threat. Despite the great progress we've made, there's still more work to do, particularly as new products are entering the marketplace like e-cigarettes and nicotine pouches.
Yeah, and I understand that the FDA recently allowed certain flavored e-cigarette products to remain on the market. Are you concerned about that decision?
Well, we're certainly seeing an environment where the FDA is more amenable to authorizing tobacco products for sale, particularly e-cigarettes and nicotine pouches, and in kid-friendly flavors. Within the past year, we've seen the FDA authorize the first fruit-flavored e-cigarettes, fruit is the most commonly used flavor among kids when it comes to e-cigarettes. And so given this environment, we're seeing more appetite by the federal government to authorize tobacco products to be on the market. And that said, it's even more important now more than ever for parents and educators and others to be vigilant to ensure that we're doing everything we can from preventing youth from using these products.
Yeah. And one thing I see a rise on a lot in social media is these nicotine pouches that can be placed under the lip and doesn't create any kind of smoke or vapor. How common are these products among young people?
So nicotine pouches are the second most commonly used tobacco product among youth after e-cigarettes, and they're actually the only tobacco product for which we've seen an uptick in use among kids over the past couple of years. So as everything else has gone down or stayed the same, there's been a slight uptick among nicotine pouches.
Because of these nicotine pouches can be placed under the lip and does it create any kind of smoke or vapor, what should parents and teachers look out for if they suspect, this child has these pouches?
There's a variety of telltale signs. The most notable are changes in mood and behavior, also changes in appetite and varying sleep patterns. All of these are signs and symptoms of nicotine dependency and addiction. We know all these products contain nicotine, which is a highly addictive psychoactive drug. And in addition to being highly addictive and influencing these behaviors, we also know that it can harm the developing adolescent brain, which continues until about age 25. And so it's critical that you look out for those signs and symptoms, be up to speed on the various products that are out there in the market, and make sure that you're well equipped to help a youth in your life if they are using these products to make sure that they quit.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the FDA. Some folks may assume that if a product is authorized by the FDA, it's automatically declared safe. What does the FDA authorization actually mean?
So the FDA is responsible for authorizing and reviewing applications for products to enter the marketplace, but there is no safe tobacco product, and they are only authorizing it for sale. They are not endorsing it as safe. And so basically, by authorizing it for sale, they've determined that the benefits of the products outweigh the risks. But that doesn't mean that there's no risks, and one of the most profound risks is youth appeal.
What can parents and schools do to speak with young people about nicotine without, making the conversation like you're being lectured to?
Well, it's important to stay informed, stay engaged, and act when needed. And so in terms of staying informed, it's important that parents and educators get up to speed on the latest products that are out there, including nicotine pouches is a great example. And then it's important to stay engaged with youth as well and have those conversations. We know that short, repeated conversations are more effective than long lectures. You also have to make sure that it's not accusatory or chastising. It's really a casual conversation with youth about the risks of these products, but also how they're being selectively targeted by an industry.
Yeah. And talking about that, I'm curious about, with the rise of these pouches now and the vapes, I remember when the vapes were coming out, I had a friend who was a heavy smoker, And, you know, he had the notion that, oh, now I have vapes that they're much healthier for me. And it just seemed like he was doing it, the vaping, more than he actually was doing smoking. Is there concern about the rise of, let's say, health concerns for young kids, mainly, like I say, cancer? Because cancer is the first thing people think of when people are smokers. But I know there's other risks like heart disease and things like that. So
we do know that these products like nicotine pouches and e-cigarettes have lower risk than a cigarette, but that doesn't mean no risk. And when it comes to kids, they shouldn't be using any form of tobacco product. And one of the main reasons why is because they're particularly vulnerable to the nicotine in these products. Nicotine is highly addictive. It can also harm the developing adolescent brain, which continues to develop until about age 25. And it can also prime the brain for addiction to using other drugs in the future. And in addition to this dependence and addiction risk, we also know that chronic exposure to nicotine at particularly high levels can lead to adverse cardiovascular effects. And so ultimately, there's multiple concerns about use of these products among kids, and it's important that we do everything we can to prevent them from using them. Although an adult smoker may potentially use these products to reduce their risk from cigarettes, there's no reason for any type of tobacco product to be in the equation for kids, including nicotine pouches or e-cigarettes. We also know that in the case of e-cigarettes, these products are coming with new technology, with gaming systems, Bluetooth compatibility. And so all of these factors, in addition to the promotion via social media, ultimately influence youth use and responsiveness to these products. And in some cases, we're seeing a return to basics in terms of how they're advertising. A great example is Formula One race cars, where cigarette advertising has been prohibited for many years. And now more recently, Formula One has started allowing advertisement for nicotine pouches. And this is a concern because Formula One has a profound youth audience. They also partner with Lego and Disney and other youth-friendly companies. And so ultimately, this advertising, including by prominent areas like Formula One, is an area of concern. It's going back to the basics, and certainly in a way that we know has influenced youth use of tobacco products, particularly cigarettes, in the past.
Yeah. Is there any recommendation as far as age, like how young Could a parent start this conversation with their child?
All the way to elementary school, hopefully, you know, have those conversations before they hit middle school when we start to see use uptick. Definitely ahead of high school where we see the highest levels of tobacco product use. But it's never too young to have these conversations and really discuss the risk of the products. Importantly, how industry has selectively targeted youth to be another generation of tobacco product users. So never too soon, but just make sure that those conversations short and repeated and also non-adversarial.
Yeah. Now, you know, as far as I understand that, you know, young people are not allowed to buy these nicotine products under, I think, 21 or is it 18?
That's correct. Yeah. The federal legal age is 21. You're correct.
So how are these young people getting these products?
Well, one of the primary sources of youth access for tobacco products is social sources. And so that's why it's particularly important as kids are heading back to school, where they may have more exposure to their friends and peers, for parents and educators to be mindful of this issue. We do know that peers may be just legal, just over 21, can also be a conduit. But ultimately, that social source is very key for access. And it's critical that parents and educators are mindful of this and do everything they can, particularly as kids are heading back to school and may have potential new exposure to these products.
What should parents and educators and policymakers each do to help, you know, prevent youth nicotine addiction?
Well, everybody serves a role. And, you know, as I noted earlier, you got to stay informed on the latest trends, particularly the new products. You have to make sure that you're engaging youth on this issue and hopefully preventing them from starting to use these products in the first place. And if they are, connect them with a healthcare provider, including a pediatrician or other qualified healthcare provider, given that this is, you know, a highly addictive psychoactive substance and drug. And so it does require professional assistance. And if you're looking for resources to help inform those conversations and actions, you can go to tobaccofreekids.org. And if there's a youth in your life who is currently using these products and you want resources to help them quit, the Truth Initiative in Mayo Clinic has a great resources at xprogram.com. That's exprogram.com.
Right. We're talking to Brian King, Executive Vice President for U.S. Programs at the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. Brian, thank you so much for joining us. I do really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Appreciate the time.
Big thanks to Patricio Rubio for that conversation. And thank you, listener, for being here with me. This has been The Local Edition. And that's it for me. I will be back again tomorrow. I'm Jason Dole. And yes, we'll have more news for you on the way in just a moment from The Daily. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and